From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to BPR Weekend. I'm Andrea Cabral, and we are broadcasting live from the GBH studio in the historic Boston Public Library in Copley Square. The Newsfeed Cafe is open, and the sun apparently has fought its way through the clouds, so if you're in the neighborhood, please come down, have a second cup of coffee, join the folks who are watching the show. My co-host is Boston Globe editorial writer Marcela Garcia. Good morning. Good afternoon, actually, because it's high noon. Good afternoon,
Andrea.
Marcela. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm really happy about this weather. It was really dreadful yesterday, but right now, like you said, it's the sun is out, people are out. Please come and join us if you are nearby.
Well, we see a lot of people out here. It's Father's Day, so we see a lot of families walking around in Copley Square. I think dads are out to get new ties and new socks and all the things.
I hope not just new ties and
greatest
socks.
Dad mugs. Those are the kinds of things that are going to be bought in public in Copley Square.
Yikes.
Today. So it was a pretty head-spinning, another head-spinning
week?
News week.
Oh my God.
Last week. But for us, some of the biggest news was last week, last Sunday, we launched BPR Weekend. It was our first show last week, and we had a really, really great show. In fact, if you didn't listen, shame on you.
Well, you can listen. You can go online and listen the last show. We got great feedback. People really liked it, and I hope it stays that way. And the people keep listening. We were very excited, and we have a great show today.
We do. We do. Again. We want to thank our guests from last week again, though. We had Harvey Silverglate, who was fantastic, and we had Nick Bilton, who wrote an excellent book on Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road, and they were great guests to have. But we do. We have a jam-packed show again today. And so let's talk a little bit about the news of the week. What was for you the biggest news story?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Harvey Silverglate, who we had as guest last Sunday. I kept thinking this week, I wonder what Harvey thinks about this, because we saw two major trials come to an end. Of course, one was the Michelle Carter trial, who was on trial for allegedly or reportedly causing the death of her boyfriend, who committed suicide. And so then, of course, the Bill Cosby trial. By the way, she was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter.
That was a surprise for a lot of people. I think a lot of people weren't sure about that. But the judge focused on, you know, as they say, three little words, get back in. She told
That's
him to get back
said.
In the truck
right.
at the point
right.
at which he was changing his mind.
Right.
And I think we'll be talking more about the Cosby trial in weeks to come because the DA intends to retry him.
Good.
But among the big stories, obviously, we had two mass shootings literally on the same day, on June 14th last week. And it's certainly revived conversation, if not action, about mass shootings and gun control. So joining us now by phone is John Rosenthal from Stop Handgun Violence. He's the co-founder of Stop Handgun Violence. And he's been described as an activist businessman and a social activist developer. And I'm not sure either of those two descriptions do him justice, but he started Stop Handgun Violence in 1995, and it's a nonprofit. It prevents and reduces injuries and deaths caused by guns. That's its mission. And since then, that organization has pretty much been at the forefront in Massachusetts for gun safety efforts, including our own gun prevention, gun violence prevention law, which is the most comprehensive in the country. John, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to BPR Weekend.
Thank you, and it's an honor to be joining you.
So, John, like Andrea said, in one of the incidents that we saw last week in Virginia, Republicans were literally shot at. They were targeted, and nobody died. And then in the other incident, three people were fatally shot by a coworker at a UPS facility in San Francisco. But in the aftermath of, for example, in the Republicans, incident when they were shot at, immediately, the reaction was, oh, if they had a gun with them, if they were carrying, you know, maybe they could have prevented, you know, or done. Again, the conversation was precisely going in the wrong direction. So my first question to you is, what do you think will be the tipping point in this country for gun reform? We saw kids literally about a year ago. We just had the anniversary of the Newton, Connecticut, where kids died. You know, what is it going to take to get us there to the tipping point?
Well, I wish I knew. I am a gun owner, and I've been the lead advocate for our first-in-the-nation consumer protection standards for firearms in Massachusetts and our comprehensive bipartisan gun laws in 98, 2004, and 2014. And I'm incredibly proud to say that Massachusetts, urban industrial Massachusetts, has the lowest gun death rate in the nation. We have a gun death rate 2 and 3 times lower than Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, and every other state, simply because we treat guns like the inherently dangerous product that they are, and we require accountability and responsibility on gun owners, dealers, manufacturers, and law enforcement. It's just not that hard to reduce injuries and deaths from an inherently dangerous product if you require accountability and responsibility. So, unfortunately, Congress has done the opposite. Congress has literally, and I hate to use this rhetoric, but it's so true, Congress has been bought off by the gun industry that has immunity from lawsuits, can market directly to criminals, and they are targeting people who shouldn't have guns to be able to buy guns because, one, you can't hold the gun industry accountable, and two, we got a Congress that would rather take money from the gun industry than protect public health and safety. So we had mass shootings this week. We have mass shootings every week. And every day, 90 people die from gun violence. Every 30 minutes, a parent or child will take a child to the hospital who's been shot. And every 3 hours, a kid will die. That amounts to 36,000 gun deaths last year, and Congress doesn't care. What's it going to take? Look, 26 and 7-year-olds didn't do it. 71 people in a movie theater before that with a made in Massachusetts Smith & Wesson AR-15 in Aurora, Colorado didn't do it. After Sandy Hook, I was asked the same question, and I said, look, maybe if 20 members of Congress were killed in their chairs like 20 babies in their chairs, they would care enough. But I don't even know if that's enough. And it's just going to take so many more than 36,000 annual gun deaths or 100 a day for Congress to find their backbone unless the American public holds them accountable at the polls.
We're talking to John Rosenthal from Stop Handgun Violence. John, but it is a fact at this point that members of Congress have now experienced it. There's always been, there's cognitive dissonance that's, I think, enhanced by the amount of money with their $300 million budget that the NRA pours into the pockets of our Congress. Because, you know, clearly 90% of American people think that there should be common sense gun safety legislation. But now that they have actually experienced it, and one of their own, sort of lies still, near death in the hospital, do you think that that will change, maybe not all minds, but enough minds and therefore enough votes? Do you think that there's a chance of that?
No, unfortunately, Andrea. What's going to happen is President Trump and the Republican Congress have already filed legislation to provide handgun concealed carry reciprocity. So, for instance, Jared Loughner, who shot Gabby Giffords in the head and killed 6 people in Arizona, in Tucson, a few years ago, went to a Walmart, passed a background check that was not complete, but passed a background check, and all of a sudden, he can carry a concealed handgun. If Congress and Trump get their way, he and others like him will be able to bring that concealed handgun with no training, no licensing, no renewable licensing, no safety training, and no consumer protection standards, all of which we require in Massachusetts, along with a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. That guy will be able to bring those weapons into Massachusetts legally if Congress gets their own way. And after every mass shooting, what the NRA and Congress say is, oh, an armed society is a polite society. But if you look at every single state that has lax gun laws, they have higher gun death rates, higher suicides, higher injury rates than urban industrial Massachusetts that arguably has the most effective gun laws. My fear here, and this is truth is stranger than fiction, guys, but The reality is that, and I'm a gun owner and a business person, so people like me have all the guns they could ever want. So what's the market? The market is criminals. How do you sell guns to criminals? You give the industry immunity from lawsuits so that they can make and market guns directly to the mentally ill, the criminals, the international terrorists. So they increase gun violence, increase fear, increase gun sales, and ultimately increase gun violence. And it's this vicious arms race. And now what you're also going to see is, we have armed criminals with AR-15 assault rifles and large-capacity ammunition magazines, like 30 and 40 rounds, while police are given their service weapons with 13 to 17 rounds. So now police, like who were at that ball field where the Republicans were shot, had handguns. So now the call is everyone should have, including the the police. It's an arms race. They need to carry assault weapons.
Sure, and it becomes a manufacturer's dream. But
exactly.
There's also a disconnect, though, in as much as if 90% of the American public believes that there ought to be common sense gun safety regulation, it's not translating into who they vote for. Because the problem is that what we believe, we believe our representatives should be representing us and reflecting what we want and when they make laws and when they take votes. But that's not happening. And yet the people who ultimately have control over that, which is the American voter, are doing nothing about it.
That's exactly right. And you have, for instance, 20% of the entire gun industry is owned by a guy, Steven Feinberg, Cerberus Capital Management.
Wow. I did not know that.
Cerberus Capital Management owns Bushmaster, Remington, the AR-15 used at Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Pulse Nightclub, 20% of the entire industry. He also happens to own Star Market and Shaw's Market, Osco Drug.
Wow, I did not know that.
And Massachusetts' third largest employer, Steward Healthcare, St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Think about this. You can buy your bread, your butter, your bullets, and your bandages, all from Steven Feinberg of Cerberus Capital Management.
Wait, does he live here in Massachusetts? Where is he based?
It's a Wall Street equity firm.
Okay, an equity firm. Got it.
But because he can't be sued, he can pour money, gobs and gobs of money, into the coffers of elected officials and the NRA, to literally put $30 million into Trump's campaign to buy, help buy the election. So, if we had campaign finance reform, real campaign finance reform, then our votes would matter.
John,
but right now you can buy Congress.
Right. This begs the question, would a boycott, a campaign to boycott these companies, for example, many of the companies are here, may do business here, would that be effective? Is that what tell people who really are interested in getting involved that this is an effective approach to boycott these companies?
Absolutely. And we have to, if you can't, we all have to go out and vote. But we also know that as a result of not having campaign finance reform, our vote is less effective. But we can vote with our wallets. And I spoke at a Moms Demand Action event recently, and really encourage women, the primary caregivers and the shoppers, to boycott Shaw's, Star, Osco Drug, and, frankly, find a new healthcare company than Steward Healthcare. And at some point, like if we boycott Trump family products, he'll leave office. I believe that with Steward Healthcare and Cerberus Capital Management and these grocery stores, we can maybe change gun policy by voting with our wallet and making this guy divest. Now, he promised, believe it or not, Steven Feinberg's father lived in Newtown, Connecticut. And after Sandy Hook, when one of Cerberus Capital Management's Bushmaster AR-15 killed 20 babies and their teachers, he said he was going to sell his Remington, Bushmaster, a Freedom Group of gun companies and ammunition companies. But then what happened is there was such a spike in AR-15s because he was saying, oh, they're going to ban AR-15s, which is what the NRA always says. Democrats are going to take our guns away, which is not the case. It runs after every mass shooting. This is why, this is the sick part, is that the gun industry wants to increase mass shootings because after every mass shooting, there's a spike in gun sales.
Right, the sales go up.
It is so, so evil. John, real quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left. We know that Massachusetts, we've mentioned that Massachusetts has one of the most strict gun laws here, but is there anything here that that is left? Is there a loophole, or is there something that we should be focusing on in Massachusetts to close such loophole, or any particular law that we're not aware of that should be passed?
Like the AG's focus on assault weapons.
Absolutely. I mean, the NRA always says, oh, we just got to enforce the existing laws. Well, all Attorney General Maura Healey's doing is enforcing the existing assault weapon bill, and they don't like it. So it's very disingenuous, but that's a great question. Yes, there's two bills that have been filed by Representative David Linsky. They need to be passed. One is to fix the private sale gun private sale background check. And the other is a protective order for domestic abusers. Those are two bills that the legislature should pass, and I believe there's a lot of support for.
Very good. Well, listen, John, we appreciate it. Tell folks who want to join you fighting the good fight how they do that.
So go to stophandgunviolence.org, and we have a page on the Cerberus boycott of Shaw's, Starr, and Osco and Stewart, and get in touch with us, and we'd be happy to get you involved. I mean, the greatest threat to the 23 years of success and the lowest gun death rate in the nation here in Massachusetts is the concealed handgun reciprocity law that Congress and Trump are going to attempt to pass to undermine our gun laws. And you've got to get involved in this issue.
That, and make sure that you vote your own interests. And in this case, the interests are apparently it's your own life that you're voting for. John, thank you so much. For joining
us. Thank you for having me.
And you have an open invitation to come back anytime.
Sadly, there'll be far too many reasons to come back.
I think that there will, but we can't say this enough. John Rosenthal is a businessman and the co-founder of Stop Handgun Violence. As he just said, you can find out more about Stop Handgun Violence by visiting the website, stophandgunviolence.org, or follow them on Twitter at Stop Handguns. Again, John, thank you so much for being here. Coming up, is it accurate to characterize what James Hodgkinson did in Alexandria last week as terrorism? And what history do nearly all mass murderers share? That conversation is next on BPR Weekend, 89.7 WGBH. We are back, and I can't say that this really came as a surprise, but almost immediately after the targeting and the shooting of those Republican congressmen at a baseball practice in Alexandria Park last week, the shooter, James Hodgkinson's rampage was being characterized as, some called it political violence, and some went as far as to call it terrorism. And the question really is, was it either of those things or both of those things, or neither? So joining us now is Joseph Brown, who's a political science professor at UMass Boston. He's also the author of the book, The Bomber Who Calls Ahead. Among other things, he specializes in peace and conflict studies and non-state actors. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you.
So let's get right into it. Of course, was it political violence? Was it terrorism? But can you also comment on, you know, why does it matter to define an incident like this under the label of terrorism? And what are the implications for the American psyche?
Well, that's a very good question. So why is it important to the psyche? I think it's generally understood that when something is an act of terrorism, the actual target of the attack is not necessarily the person who was harmed. Acts of terrorism, generally speaking, have a performative aspect or a psychological aspect. So there is an act of violence. It targets a particular person or a particular location physically, but there is a message behind the action. And I think if you walk that back, we're all sort of implicitly aware that that's what terrorism is. When someone calls it terrorism, you take notice because you realize that there is a message directed at you. Mm-hmm. So you are actually involved as the recipient of the political message, and the sort of the message usually travels via fear. You hear the word terrorism, and you know that you are supposed to be afraid.
Do you think that's what this was, terrorism?
I don't think we have conclusive evidence of that mm-hmm. yet. So generally speaking, terrorism is political violence. This is violence against a politician, and the person appears to have had strong political views.
Sure.
In that sense, it's political violence. It's not clear that there was a message behind the act, however. Mm-hmm. So there's no manifesto that this person has left. The person was killed in the process of carrying out the attack. It's not like the person's going to be, like the shooter will be put on trial and then they'll give a speech saying, here's why I did this, here's mm-hmm. my message. Perhaps there was an intended message, but we can't see what it would have been at this point. And unless it's clear that there's a message behind the action, I think it's premature to call it terrorism. At this mm-hmm. point, it's political violence. It's an attempted murder. But it's not clear yet whether it was just a grudge against this one person or a grudge against Republicans versus violence that's intended to make a statement to Americans in general or Republicans in general.
Isn't that usually when a person is engaged in terrorist activity, certainly not always, but there usually are signs, maybe not to the level of a manifesto, but perhaps a Facebook posting or friends that can sort of come forward and say that this person was adhering to a particular view that we recognize as being shared perhaps by others who might be carrying out similar acts, you know, around the world. This does seem to me to be a little bit different. And like you said, he's not here. We don't actually know what it was that he was beyond, you know, some of his writings, what he was intending to do, because we can't talk to him. But he seemed to be a person who was filled with rage, and I often wonder whether or not people gravitate toward a political ideology as a way to vent their rage, or it's the politics that they come to believe in that make them angry. And I think that makes a difference between just a angry lone wolf and someone who is even genuinely politically motivated.
So I think that there's. It's hard to sort out whether people who are angry are drawn to particular ideologies or whether ideologies make them angry.
Right.
I think the answer is yes and yes.
Okay.
I think that you can see evidence of that, too, if you look at the life histories sometimes of people who do violent things, that they kind of bounce from ideology to ideology. And then that kind of supports one of those accounts that angry people
are looking for
a
fit. They're looking for something that fits.
I am a radical in search of an ideology to manifest my radicalism, or I'm an angry person in search of an ideology. Those two things are actually distinct, radicalism versus anger. But I think that in this case, yes, the answer is yes to both. This person appears to have been an angry person. He was the shooter was violent at home, so there's a history of domestic violence there as well.
We want to talk about that in some depth.
Well, yeah. Why don't you, you know, give us your insight as to why, you know, this correlation has or hasn't been explored enough? I don't know what your sense is, if it has been explored enough, and why is it important for us to look at that? I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, these are signs, right? Obviously, not every domestic violent or domestic abuser is going to turn into a mass shooter. But you know, I think the numbers are very stark. It's like 50% or 50-something percent of mass shooters have had a history of domestic violence. Can you give us some insight into that correlation?
Sure. So in this man's case, it's hard to say that ideology turned him violent. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to have had radical political views. His political views do not seem all that out of the American norm.
He did vote for Jill Stein, I'm just saying.
But I thought he was a Bernie Sanders.
Maybe my standards are...
Yeah, there's radical and then there's radical.
Yeah, Jill Stein. So Jill Stein would be appalled by that, I think, rightly so.
I'm fairly certain she would be, yes.
So it's pretty clear that the person's political views, as far as we can tell now, were not radical. So it's not like you can say this, that the politics of Jill Stein or politics of American left-wing politics turned him violent. But you do see a pre-existing history of violence, and it appears to have manifested in attacking politicians in this particular case. It does seem that people who engage in lone actor violence, but also organized political violence by groups, have committed violence against domestic partners and their children and nieces and nephews before. There is definitely a link if you look at the histories of those people who commit violence. I would just add a caveat there to say, in order to say that domestic abuse turns you into a mass shooter, we're not there yet in terms of the evidence that exists. You'd have to look at all of the people who do and don't commit domestic abuse and see if the ones who commit domestic abuse are at a higher risk of turning into political shooters or lone wolf terrorists, whatever you want to, whichever category we're going to look at.
Well, it is, and it is really, as Marcella said, it is quite stock. So, and it's international. So I just made a quick list of some of the more recent shootings. So in France, Mohamed Boulel, who drove the truck through the crowd in Nice, he had a history of domestic violence. The Pulse nightclub shooter, Omar Martin, in Florida, had a history of domestic violence. Robert Louis Deer, who shot up the Planned Parenthood clinic, also. In Australia, there was someone, I had never heard of this man, whose first name, quite frankly, is Man, is M-A-N, Haron Monis. He held hostages for 17 hours. And Australia has very little of this because they had strict gun control laws from 20, 30 years ago. They had a mass shooting and they just put an end to it all. But this particular man held hostages for 17 hours. He killed two, wounded four. In the UK, Khalid Massoud, who was behind the Westminster attacks, domestic violence history, and Dylan Roof, who was the Charlestown church shooter, grew up in a family that had significant violence. So can you speak to what's very prominent always in domestic violence cases are the issues of power and control and the deep powerlessness that the abuser actually feels versus what they project. What's the correlation between that and becoming a mass shooter?
Yes. So I just want to qualify anything I say by saying I'm not actually an expert on domestic violence.
That's okay. I am. I prosecuted cases for 16 years.
So you've got
that
one covered.
I've got that one covered.
That's good. So what I will say is Dylan Roof is a really important person to bring up in this context. And I think it's important to say that the lone shooter phenomenon is generally not associated with mainstream American leftists leftists in general. If you want to look at this phenomenon, you really will end up picking up a lot more right-wing people than left-wing people. Also more right-wing Americans than Muslims. The Anti-Defamation League and the Government Accountability Office put out statistics showing that something like 73 or 74% of the lone shooter incidents are perpetrated by right-wingers, and something like 24% are radical Islamists, and 2% are leftists. Dylan Roof is
That's very important. I hope people were really listening to that, because that is the bootstrap justification for lots of things. And I just want to quickly let people know, we're talking to Joseph Brown from UMass. He's a professor of political science there. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. Dylan Roof actually is pretty clearly someone you could put in the terrorist category, because he did write a manifesto, and there is a political, specifically white supremacist message that he puts out there. And one of his supposed grievances is he claims that black men commit violence against white women. So you can look at this man's life history. He's a person who might have been exposed to domestic violence or otherwise involved in it, and the act itself is rationalized by wanting to control women, lashing out at black men for trying to control white women. So you can see there's wrapped in with all the white supremacist garble in that manifesto, there's the logic of wanting to have control over women, maybe feeling like he doesn't have control over them. So you could see if there's a link between domestic violence and terrorism, which there certainly appears to be, anecdotally, there is a common thread of people feeling like their masculinity has been challenged, and domestic abuse is a kind of toxic way of reclaiming masculinity, and terrorism in a lot of cases is a toxic way of reclaiming masculinity. Groups like ISIS and Boko Haram, the organized mass violence terrorist type groups, often recruit by promising people access to women.
Right. So it's sort of a core mission, part of their mission
statement.
I mean,
also the reason why it's gendered. I mean, you don't see female mass shooters, although I'm sure, has there been any female mass shooter in history?
There are examples. Well, so the San Bernardino attacks, for instance, there is a
couple carrying out
a mass shooting. And in that case, the woman was a full participant in the act. There are also female suicide bombers out there. ISIS recruits whenever it can. Groups like ISIS will recruit female suicide bombers. So women do engage in political violence on a mass scale.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you want to look at the correlation between domestic violence and lone wolf violence, if there is a causal relationship, it's probably toxic masculinity driving both phenomena.
Hmm. What would you say to people? I mean, right now you were saying earlier about the Alexandria, Virginia shooter, how you wouldn't define it as terrorism, but there is clearly a sense in the country that, you know, there's fear. There is fear and there's frustration, and a lot of it comes, you know, from our political times we're living, right? So, you know, thinking historically, has there ever been a time in American history that where you see, you know, a similar moment being, you know, and how has the country reacted, and you know, how has the government reacted? Again, even though this wasn't terrorism per se, people feel fear and frustration, and it comes from the right, it comes from the left, and you know, what would you offer to people historically? Is there a lesson in history to learn there?
Well, the first thing, if you want to talk about terrorism, is usually don't be afraid. Especially in America, you're actually really safe from terrorism. Terrorists kill fewer people than deer.
Sure.
Jumping out in front of cars.
You can't say those things often enough.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. If anything,
that's a great message.
The problem with terrorism, the best counterterrorism policy you could have is to tell people again and again what those statistics are. It's like getting struck by lightning.
Right, right.
Don't change what you're doing. Don't stop going to baseball games. You're as likely to be killed by terrorists as you are to be struck by lightning.
We got to wrap up.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. Joseph Brown is a PhD and professor of political science at UMass. You can find him at www.josephmbrown.com or follow him on Twitter at @Joseph_M_Brown. Coming up, in honor of Father's Day, we take a look at some of our favorite and not so favorite TV dads with our expert, BU Professor of Communication, John Hall. We'll be taking your calls at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970.